Well, without further ado, brother, we'll give Eric Skill here.
All right, brother.
Okay. Thank you. Christ is come. It's a wonderful hymn. And we didn't get to it yet. We'll get to it at the end of the discourse. We'll go through those last two verses. But as you've got your hymn book maybe open, I love verse 4. With this blessed hope before us, let no harp remain unstrung. Let the mighty ransomed chorus onward roll from tongue to tongue. So with that in mind, we'd like to rekindle a bit of the fervor of the early truth movement and the sense of the mission that they had. You know, theirs was to proclaim the imminence of the end of the age and the coming of the kingdom. A distinguishing feature of the Bible student movement was the heralding of the harvest of the age. That second advent, so fervently anticipated for centuries, had now become a reality. Christ was present, although unseen, overruling the actions and affairs of men for their ultimate good. This was the vision, and when compared with the more somber and terrifying view of Orthodox Christianity, there is small wonder at the zeal and energy which the Bible students set about proclaiming the message, nor the interest aroused and the acceptance it received. Good tidings of great joy, they insisted, and so it was.
You can turn it up here.
The passion with which these saints pursued their mission was motivated by the love of the beautiful message they had to proclaim. As it says in 1 Corinthians 4:1, they were ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. These harvest workers were eager to share the message, speaking the truth in love and growing up into Him in all things, which is the head, even Christ, Ephesians 4:15. They experienced acceptance and rejection, elation and discouragement, and how essentially these experiences were for personal growth. Yes, those bold witnesses to Jehovah's true message, were turning the world upside down. And I've chosen that because it's a unique phrase in the King James translation. It's in Acts 17 where Paul and Silas and Timothy were preaching to the Jews on their journey from Philippi to Thessalonica. And starting in verse 1 of chapter 17, we read, "Now, when they came to Thessalonica, where was the synagogue of the Jews, and Paul, as his manner was, went into them, and 3 Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ, the Messiah that they had been awaiting." Continuing on, "And some of them believed and consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks, a great multitude, and of the chief women, not a few. But the Jews believed not. Moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of a baser sort, and gathered a company and set all the city on an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. And when they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, "These have turned the world upside down, and come hither also, whom Jason has received, and these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus." And these troubled people and the rulers of the city, when they heard, these troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. Well, you can see that the Jews realized that there was, in fact, a great conflict between Judaism and what Paul was preaching, what Christianity, basically. And that wherever the two came in contact, there would be a clash. If Christianity was correct, their world would be turned upside down. In reprint 43:16, the pastor relates the following lesson for us. So long, therefore, as the apostles could reasonably properly find hearers for the master's words, they preached it. And so it was, must be with us. We must not be intimidated. While obedient to the powers that be, respecting every earthly way, we, like the apostles, cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. To keep the message secret, to put our light under a bushel would mean our own failure to progress and the dwarfing of our new nature. End of quote. In the early 1900s, these concepts of the kingdom, the Lord's presence, and our share in the heirship with Christ were new. They were new to many who were receiving this witness from the brethren. And in turn, the hearers that received the message into good and honest hearts became proclaimers to others.
I started to attend the meeting way back in 1918. And we had a Friday night meeting in Reading, Pennsylvania. And the leader of that meeting, for some reason or other, asked me to read Galatians 3:8. I read it. He said, "Now what do you get from that?" I said, "There's nothing else to get except that God foresaw that He, God, would justify the heathen through faith and preach the gospel beforehand to Abraham, and the gospel was that he would bless all the families of the earth." He says, "That's beautiful." He says, "Read the 16th verse." So I read the 16th. What do you get from that? I said, "There's nothing else to get from that. The seed of Abraham that would bless all the families of the earth is Christ." He says, "That's right. When you go to the end of the chapter, and if you be Christ, then you are Abraham, seeing an heir to the promise." I jumped off my seat. The first time that this doctrine came to my mind, or came to my heart. If you are Christ, if you belong to Christ, then you are the seed of Abraham, to whom God would bless all the families of the earth. I've never been the same since. I don't expect that. I hope I never change.
Like those harvest workers, as an example here in the early years, there are many today who love the harvest message and are eager to share it. None are more passionate than some of our brethren in India and in Africa. And we were privileged this last year to share that enthusiasm that they have, as we met with them in Uganda, in Kenya, and in the Congo. And we'd like to share a little bit of showing you their enthusiasm. It's like the beginnings of the truth movement. These are the Congo brethren that are traveling. They've been traveling for 3 days. You can keep that up, Estelle. And I think they were singing the whole time, because as they were arriving, they should have been tired and weary and just saying, where is the bed? And they're just singing and singing. And they're, as you count them coming out of the van, I think you'll number about 17 people coming out of this van. I don't know how they all fit, but just listen to this enthusiasm. And they're still coming out. More. You know, you would think they'd be ready for a rest. This was the middle of the afternoon. But all they could think of is they were anxious to get to the studies. And anxious and attentive to learn more of the truth. They, as soon as they wanted to get there, just sit down and start asking questions. And there's Brother Rick Cunningham answering some of those questions. And these are not simple things that they're asking. They're going into quite depth. I think you're talking about church-state situations in this particular conversation.
What that teaches
us... They have to translate into three different languages everything that's spoken, so it's a little complicated. The meetings went all morning and all afternoon, and there basically was one break during the day at lunchtime for a half an hour. So you're basically going a four-hour meeting, a break, and another four-hour meeting. You had your next break at 8:30 at night for dinner. And they were extremely attentive and diligent in their studies. You notice everybody taking notes. And the sisters were very diligent. There were about 100 people that they had to feed, and here they are in their kitchen. That is the kitchen. There is no indoor kitchen. And there's no modern appliances. That's wood fires or charcoal fires that they're cooking everything on. And
pounded yam.
And they have, but they were so enthusiastic, really praising Jehovah for the real good news that they are able to share. You know, many in African communities are ready to hear a more sensible and loving message that this spurs on numerous elders there to lecture in the small towns and churches with enthusiasm. And it's just amazing. But you can have a gulp so they can hear the sound. instead of a piano, you have clapping to keep your rhythm. This enthusiasm they have and dedication, I think, is something that, you know, I'd like to see rekindled in us. It's something that reminds me of...
I forgot what I'm talking about.
Oh, you just, after you just click that down, get it out of the way.
Okay.
Or pull the other one up. Pull the other screen up.
That one.
That one. And then go to full screen on it. It's just a tremendous enthusiasm that kind of reminds us of this, you know, the early truth movement, as I said. It's the kind of thing where as you're with them and you see their enthusiasm and they're going out and they go into churches, they find somebody and they say, you know, can we talk to the pastor? And they talk to the pastor and say, can we, we've got some things we want to preach in your church, and can we come in and talk to your congregation? And, oh, sure, that sounds good. And they bring them in and they talk. And then sometimes the pastor is converted right there to the new message and brings his congregation with him. And sometimes it doesn't happen that way. Sometimes it's just the congregation, the few of them, leave the church and go with the brethren, but it's just a remarkable situation, because they are hearing something, the real good news that we have of the two salvations, of the absence of the fire in the hell, and the opportunities of being in the high calling and working with Jesus to bless all of mankind. This is brand new to so many of them, and it just spurs them on to keep on going. Well, here, you know, for each one of us, I think we're all sometimes, and it's usually fear that does this, fear of rejection, we're reluctant maybe to witness. Or maybe we feel that we don't have the talent. Oh, let Brother Bob Gray do it. He has the talent. Boy, he just talks to anybody he sits down with. Well, in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 17, it says, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech," you know, not because he had the talent, "so that the cross of Christ would be made void."
Not
be made void. Excuse me. Christ would not be made void. And in the second chapter of 1 Corinthians in verse 4 and 5, "My teaching and message were not delivered with skillful words of human wisdom, but with convincing proof of the power of God's Spirit. Your faith, then, does not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power." That's from the Good News Bible version. At 80 years old, Moses had been called of the Lord to the great and honorable work of delivering his people from the bondage of Egypt. But Moses, of course, in Exodus 4, as we know, said to the Lord, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And the Lord said to Moses, "What is that in thine hand?" So we can see that what he wants us to use might be right in our hands too. Okay, let's put this to the test. What's in your hands right now? Now, usually I'd say a Bible, but I see an awful lot of pads and computers and little digital devices sitting around too. But same thing. What's that in our hand? Then, and we also have pens, paper, all these things, we have the tools. But what did the brethren in the early truth movement have that we don't always have? Okay, this is a question kind of like the Wizard of Oz. Now, what's behind the screen? You got three choices, you know, or what are the components of the three characters that were the main characters in the Wizard of Oz, and what did they want the wizard to give them? Well, one said a brain. I heard somebody say that here. And the other one said a heart. Well, what's the one that fits most with us? Courage. Yes, courage. When the Lord asked Moses, "What is in thy hand?" He was assuring Moses that Jehovah himself would be responsible and that he would direct the matter. It wasn't to be on Moses' courage, of his own courage. And the early truth movement, like Moses, had the assurance that God would direct and overrule all of their witness efforts. They really believed, as we should too, in Philippians 4:13, that they could have the courage because they could do all things through Christ who strengthens them. This trust does not come from just calling on the Lord in times of crisis either, but practicing trust on a daily basis. And we've got a good example of that with David coming before Goliath in 1 Samuel 17:45. I'll just quote it here. It says, "Then said David to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied." So the lesson here is that we, like David, come in the name and power of the Lord. With that in mind, and we'll show some examples here, think of how some of the meekest brethren have been bold for the Lord and through His power.
2 Samuel 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 1 Brother Russell put me in the charge on the bookstore. That is, in charge, the day-to-day, the brethren that were working there, their literature, their whatever they needed to bring that store, and also friends would come in and buy things, buy some cords, buy Bibles, and so I had all that to do. Then, that was the photodrama work.
Why the lake? our reading and studies were hindered by our creeds. Now nobody would think of defending any of the creeds. But as our faith in human creeds dies, our trust in the Bible as divine increases because we understand it better.
In reprint 3700, the pastor tells us we should have compassion upon others who still ignorantly misrepresent and our energy misrepresent God, and our energies should be continually bent to their assistance, that the eyes of their understanding might open up more widely to perceive the lengths and breadths and heights and depths, and to know the love of God which passes all understanding. End of quote. There's nothing more exciting, as many here know, than being released from the chains of darkness and error, being released from the bondage of the creeds of men. This was the excitement by far. I mean, there weren't people who grew up in the truth movement. And so this was the excitement of those early pioneers who gathered.
As soon as I heard it explained, I just loved it. I knew it was the truth. And we had a little later on tabernacle study in our home. And I just rather ate it up as a young girl. I took in as much of it as I could. And we just were determined to stick to the truth, to study the real truth, and to be loyal to it, loyal to what we knew was the Lord's truth and not man's. And it wasn't an easy time, but the Lord bless us.
None of us left here on the platform, at the other hall, and at other places in London. It's a completely round building with four main entrances. It's the largest hall. It seats 7,000 people. Largest hall in London. And there are cans. And the outside, there were thousands of people struggling to get in. And the organizers and the elders who organized it all, they had a chain of teenagers, which I was one at the time. To hold the doors shut against the crowds, the glass doors, and there we were, half a dozen, at least the four doors, holding the doors shut, and outside the people were struggling to get in. I can still see their faces, and pushing, shutting, anything to get in the hall and hear the lecture. Oh, it was tremendous, yes, tremendous enthusiasm. Anybody who had any contact with what we called the truth was expected to go out and put their tracts. Things of this size then opened out. They were like newspapers. And in consequence, when Britain were putting tracts out, somebody had to stand at a strategic point with stocks because you couldn't carry all the ones you could put out there. Few hours, if you spend a couple of hours on that, you'd have to go back about two or three times to get fresh supplies to carry. And two big bags on each side of the bike, full of tracks, and one in the basket in front.
Within the framework of the Bible students, there was a burning desire to forward this message of the kingdom, of restitution, and and gather in the safety class to be the bride of Christ. So this work was a very energetic work, and the work was done not by a great deal of money, but it was at the sacrifice of many, many individuals. Everyone was kind of engaged in this work. They were either tracking or co-ordering, and then later on, they had the photodrama of creation. So not only did Brother Russell use people out in the field, tracking, at Bethel, pilgrim service, they were brethren that were contacted the newspapers, and I remember Will Hollister telling me how he was approached by Pastor Russell. He was called in one day to Pastor Russell, wanted to talk to him, and he said, "Will, I want you to go to India and to the Far East to be my liaison man, to arrange for meetings and the newspaper work and so on over there to get that started." So Bill Hollister was kind of surprised, but he wasn't going to say no, but he said one qualifier. He said that he had his eye on a certain sister named Grace. And he said, "Well, if Grace will agree to go with me, I'll go." So she agreed, and they were married, and they went on their honeymoon on their mission over there to carry on the work. That's how it was done. It was, people were just engaged.
Our father was very upset with the way the church of England, Church of England, and he went to the minister and asked a number of questions, but he didn't get the satisfaction of not satisfying to him. He was one day reading in the office at a time, you know, mealtime, and he was reading a book on Catholicism, that's right. And he thought, you see, it's a little bit better than the Church of England because it's got purgatory. That is a help, you see, help, not go straight into death. It's hellfire, yes. So, but one of the office fellows there went up to him and said, "Oh, Dan, you shouldn't be there. I've got much better books for you." So he brought it up to him, and it was the first one. It's the Divine Plan of the Ages. So he thought, "Oh, this is just wonderful." Once he started reading, he couldn't stop. And he said, "This is it. This is the truth."
At the age of 9 years old, I attended a Church of England Sunday school, and the Sunday school teachers wanted me to be confirmed in the Church of England, and at that age I was instructed to learn the St. Athanasius Creed, which appears in the Church of England prayer book. Well, as I learned this, on one side of the page it said there were three gods, there were three lords, but you turned over the page and then you found that there were not three gods, there were not three lords. And so in my young mind I decided that, well, if they can't make up their mind as to whether there are three gods or not, then I'm not going to be confirmed. And I went home that Sunday and explained to my father that, if they can't make up their mind regarding the creed, I'm not interested and I don't want to go to Sunday school anymore. If you send me to Sunday school, I shall go for a walk in the forest. Well, as it happened, the next Sunday, nothing was said to me about going to Sunday school, and I never went. But halfway through the morning, Father said to me, "Would you like to come with me to a Bible lecture tonight? I'm going to one at Forest Gate, And that would have entailed, in my young years, a train ride, then a 3/4 mile walk, and a bus ride of some 3 miles, which in those days was quite a thing. And I sat enthralled at what I'd heard. And as a result, I also read Volume 1. And we still rejoice in the truth that we originally got from Brother Russell, of course.
Positiveness and devotion marked these brethren. And so too it was with Ruth. And that's King David's great-granddaughter. In Ruth 1:16, it says, "Thy people shall be my people." The story, and I'm going to read a little bit here from reprint 56:13. The story of the book of Ruth gives us a little glimpse into the affairs of the Israelites, showing us there was a deep and underlying spirit of respect for the Lord. And this is shown in the meanings of the names. Amalek, the husband's name, signifies "My God is king." His wife, Naomi, is said to mean "the pleasures of Jehovah." This family in the story here became discouraged because of the invasions of the enemies in that land and the frequent loss of the fruits of their labor, and finally a severe drought which almost produced a famine. And so they left their home and crossed Jordan into the land of Moab and dwelt there for 10 years. There, two boys married. Unfortunately, both died, leaving widows. And Amalek also died, evidently believing of the land of promise, the land of the covenant, to live amongst people who were idolaters and who were not in a covenant relationship with God, had not exactly resulted in a benefit for the family. We read in chapter 1 of Ruth how Naomi determined that they should return to Judah, but Naomi was reluctant to make her daughters-in-law move to an unfamiliar land. This was all they had known. They had grown up in this situation. But Ruth, the one daughter-in-law, would not part from Naomi. We read from the King James Version in Ruth 1:16-17. It says, "But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me.'" We see here that Ruth then went with Naomi from Moab and actually ended up in Bethlehem, even though it would mean leaving everything behind. But there was a positiveness in her decision, because she saw the true value in what Naomi had told her about God and his favor upon the Israelites. We also see this positiveness, this positive attitude in all true Christians. This should be our attitude: quick to leave behind any earthly goods and ambitions. Well, on arriving in Bethlehem, Ruth went out, like the other poor women, and went to glean handfuls of grain from the corners. You know, under the law, part of God's provision was that the corners of the fields would be left untouched for the poor. And Naomi counseled Ruth to go gleaning the fields at the land of one of her wealthy relatives, who was named Boaz. Well, we're going to look at the New American Translation of chapter 2, verse 5. It says, "Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, 'Whose young woman is this?' The servant in charge of the reapers replied, 'She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab.' And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' Thus she came and remained from the morning until now, and has just now stopped to rest for a while under the shelter." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go to glean in any other field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one, but stay here with my maids." He continues and says, "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." Skipping to verse 15. "When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, 'Let her glean even from the sheaves and do not insult her. Also, you may purposely pull out from for her some of the grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean and do not rebuke her.'" So he was putting in front of her on purpose sheaves of grain. Note that Jehovah arranged it that she was blessed for her diligence to glean even the small amount of wheat left in the field, which really for us is an encouragement because it corresponds to giving us encouragement, blessing us if we have a desire to witness, even though there may be few grains left, even with few results. Now, this for Ruth gained her favor in the eyes of Boaz, which symbolically we think was a symbol of Jesus, the Lord of the harvest. And so that he rewarded her just as our Lord rewards and encourages many of the Ruth class today, as he will everyone here when we are diligent, and he will give us little successes. He won't leave us without any grains to find, without any interest, without any results, but he'll give us small amounts at least of successes to our efforts to glean those last grains of wheat.
I was born April 23rd, 1893, in McGregor, Iowa, a beautiful little town on the bluffs of the Mississippi River. In 1893, my father received Volume 1 from Brother Charles Jordan, who owned the General Store. When my father began reading The Divine Plan of the Ages, he continued reading way into the night. And by the time he finished the chapter, Nature's Distinct, he realized he had found the truth. Of course, he immediately withdrew from the Methodist Church. My mother was a church organist, and she never accepted the truth. My father used Zion's Glad Songs as the music book for the school where he taught, and each day he opened the class with a scripture verse. As a child, I loved to read. I read Scripture Studies, Volume 1, when I was 9. I always had a strong feeling for the Lord and His Word. I consecrated in 1908 at the age of 15. My sister Jenny sent money, so my father, younger sister, and I could attend our convention. My turn came in 1912, and I went to the convention in Fertile Springs, Missouri. It was my first opportunity to be immersed. Brother Russell gave the baptism talk. We were richly blessed in our study and fellowship in the Madison class. One brother had a roadster, and Sister Oki and I would sometimes go to and from meeting, standing on the running board, she on one side and I on the other. Looking back over a century, I praise the way the Lord has led me day by day. My physical strength and memory are fading, but I pray that I will never forget the Abrahamic promise, the corresponding pride, and God's four attributes. Through all the years, I have rejoiced in God's attributes of wisdom, justice, love, and power, so beautifully revealed in the divine plan of the ages. My advice to anybody younger is to fill their minds with the good things of the truth, because they are going to need them when eyesight goes and health goes. Dear brethren, I urge you to use your time, talents, privileges, and opportunities so you can look back with joy and not with regret. God be with you till we meet again.
God never in all history has left himself without a witness. And now, in what is perhaps the most momentous period of world history, we are given that privilege and must muster faith and strength in the Lord to give that witness.